The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Very small scale loans to the
human rights, and doing so is not an unlawful act, and individuals should not be punished for doing so, as it is also stipulated in the 1951 Convention. In order not to violate these rights, open and humane reception arrangements should be the norm and not the exception. The detention should in principle be avoided, be a measure of last resort, and should be prescribed by law, and be applied only where necessary, reasonable, and proportionate to a legitimate purpose. I hope that our detention guidelines have been made available, and you will see these are the principles that are enunciated in the recently released detention guidelines on alternatives to detention as well. And beyond the rights implications, UNHCR is concerned that detention impedes meaningful access to asylum procedures and has a well-documented, highly negative impact on the individual asylum seeker or migrant, particularly if the person is a survivor of trauma or torture. For these reasons, UNHCR and other stakeholders have worked for more than a decade to protect these rights in the context of growing use of deprivation of liberty in the context of immigration enforcement efforts. And balancing the legitimate interest of a state to control irregular migration with the fundamental rights of asylum seekers and either migrants, this has been a difficult thing to do, particularly following the tragic events of September 11, 2001. And key to this balance is the development of a broad-based, robust system of alternatives to detention. And what do we mean by alternatives to detention? That refers to any legislation, policy, or practice that allows asylum seekers and others to reside in the community subject to a number of conditions or restrictions on their freedom of movement. And UNHCR sees ATD, or alternatives to detention, including all practices that offer individualized assessments as to need to deprive liberty, as key measure to preventing arbitrary restrictions on liberty of asylum seekers and other persons of concern to UNHCR, and have committed to working with governments and civil society to promote expanded and enhanced ATD practices. And what is it that UNHCR has done? UNHCR has undertaken a number of global efforts to promote the enhanced use of ATDs. These include the issuance of a joint UNHCR Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights report, which is titled Back to Basics, and that is now getting back to which is allowing people to enjoy the freedom of movement, which report highlights the international human and refugee rights framework, and several case studies are included in that particular report. So I would highly encourage you to try and get hold of the report itself. And in conjunction with other international governmental organizations, civil society, and governments, we have organized global, regional, and national roundtables on alternatives to detention. And that touches pretty much every continent. And the last roundtable was organized in Buffalo, New York, in September last year. I'm looking at Andrew and Grant and Megan, where participants were sharing experiences on good practices, and government delegations were present from Australia, from Sweden, from Canada, and principally from the US as well. And the summary conclusions of the binational roundtable, I think, have been shared with everybody up there. And now today's event builds on all this work and offers an important moment to continue the dialogue on ATD here in the US. And beyond a brief overview of the legal framework, which I have provided for context, the goal of the discussion today is threefold. One, to understand key developments and the future trajectory for detention and ATD globally. Secondly, to contextualize this trajectory in the US terms by discussing the status of detention and ATD domestically. And thirdly, to discuss opportunities and constraints from both the NGO and US government perspective. So to help us in this effort, we have put together this distinguished panel. And here we are, and it's interesting how they are seated, but in any case, I will say the name and they'll be nodding in any case, starting with Grant Michel, who is the director of the International Detention Coalition, who is based in Australia. He is everywhere, Mexico and Asia, at times in beautiful Australia. And he who will speak then from the global perspective on important developments, empirical research, and good country practices on ATD. And then we have Megan Brunner, who is the acting director of Access to Justice Unit with Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, who is based in Baltimore.
Baltimore, yes.
In Baltimore, Maryland. I told you I love Baltimore, US. And who will discuss with us ATD in the US context, highlighting in particular LIRS's Community Support Network, which provides case management, community-based ATD services, and will probably together with Andrew and last but not least, we have Andrew Lorenzen-Strait, who is the senior advisor with enforcement and removal operations and commonly known as ERO, who is based in Washington, D.C., at U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And Andrew will be focusing on the U.S. government's ATD arrangements and important developments in its use of alternatives, including leveraging NGO capacity. So that being said, now the format is going to be this way. I will be monopolizing the stage, asking them questions. They will respond, and at some point I will get tired because I acknowledge your presence around there, and then I will request you to be kind enough to ask them questions. Now let's start with Grant. You have been working on global issues, and you have been also at the forefront of the issue of alternatives to detention globally. Can you talk to us about some of the most important developments in this area and tell us if there are any positive trends or negative trends? Don't hesitate.
Okay, thank you, Bhuti. Just the background, the International Detention Coalition, so we're a civil society network. We have members in 50 countries and working very actively on this issue. So I've personally, over the last 5 years, been to 40 countries visiting detention centres and looking at good and bad practices. So we've seen everything from prison cells to hotel rooms being used as places of detention, everything from an island to detention to deserts, and everything in between. So I think in looking at it from a distance, as we try to get some perspective, there's really two key global trends. There's clearly a massive growth globally on the use of immigration detention. Governments are increasingly using immigration detention as a perceived tool to be able to manage irregular migration, often used in the first instance. It's often far less regulated than, as we heard earlier, than criminal or other forms of detention. And an interesting finding for us is country upon country that we go to, including some years ago here, that it's like a one-size-fits-all approach to someone undocumented arriving or intercepted in a territory, that they are seen as a risk and they're locked up. So it doesn't matter if you are a child or if you are potentially seeking protection, a refugee, or other vulnerable person. So we've seen the impact of detention varies, but the impact is great across all regions. Clearly, there's a heightened risk of human rights abuses if you have very little access to a place of detention, as we know in the general prison systems around the world as well. Conditions vary. Obviously, a lot of concerns about the impact on children and vulnerable groups with mental health. It's unfortunate to say that we've seen many of the models that governments are using, the way they're detaining, came from the United States. So, in fact, the US model of immigration detention, which was particularly based around interception, in some cases mandatory detention, use of private companies running these facilities. That's unfortunately becoming a norm globally. I'm from Australia, and our detention system there mirrors the US considerably. In fact, we have US security companies running our detention facilities, and we're seeing that globally. So that's been a real concern to us. But what's been interesting is an opposite trend, a complete shift away from detention in the first instance in a number of countries. That's really been going for, say, since 2008-09, there's been just a massive growth. And interestingly, the US has been very influential in that positive trend. So when President Obama announced in 2009 that he would reform immigration detention here, it had a ripple-on effect. A lot of countries around the world, we observed, there was a global roundtable on this issue, which UNHCR co-hosted in Geneva in 2011, and we could see then just the announcement from the US president, let alone the reality of what happened here, just the announcement kind of got a number of other countries looking at this issue. And I would say there's a few motivations around the reforms that we've seen. I mean, clearly cost has been an issue. Detention facilities over the world are extremely costly. Equally, the growing litigation that's been happening for wrongful and negligent cases. So in Australia, our reform effort was because of the amount of people suing the government. And then we had also the impact on vulnerable groups. So in Belgium, which massively reformed its detention system in 2009 and 10 and released all children from detention, that was basically because of the concern about the unnecessary and very damaging impact on children. So since that time, we've clearly seen alternatives to detention is on the UN agenda. It's being implemented around the world. We've done extensive research on this, which is on the desk outside, and we've found 50 different types of alternatives. And I won't go into them all, but just to say they range everything from preventative mechanisms, so ways states are just avoiding detention right from the beginning, such as risk assessment, which we'll hear about, through to community structured release, so ways people are being managed in the community, through finally to we found 14 different supervision mechanisms, different ways states are putting reporting on someone or are requiring some obligation on that person. So in terms of just really quickly good practice, in that period of time, from say the Obama reform announcement to a few months ago, I mean, we've seen masses of implementation at the national level. So in 2010, only two-thirds of European Union countries, so all of the states in Europe, had any form of alternative to detention in law. As of the end of last year, almost all states had, bar two. And equally, my country, Australia, doubled its alternative to detention programs and the amount it invested in those programs in that time. We had the new French president, one of his first announcements was that he would end the detention of children and increase alternatives. And we've seen release of children from everywhere from Japan to Thailand. So we can clearly say there are very good encouraging practices, and alternative seems to be a buzzword that is gaining traction. So it's very encouraging.
Well, thanks, Quint. What comes to mind is, you were talking about, for example, the influence that the U.S. government has had, both negatively and positively. What role has civil society played in this renaissance of alternative to international activism?
Do you mind repeating the question? I'm sorry, we can't.
The question is, he was focusing on the role that the export value of the U.S.'s reforms in the area of tourism, firstly negatively and now positively, since 2008-2009. But what about the role that civil society would play?
What's interesting is that as states increasingly have assumed they need to detain because there's a security risk, we've seen the opposite in the community. You know, community groups from, I have my colleague from Mexico here, extensive experience in communities running shelters and managing groups in the community. So community and civil society, religious faith-based groups often have a lot of knowledge in how to work with people in complex situations, which often states don't have. You know, states detain or nothing. You know, you're in detention or you're on your own. So I think that civil society, from my perspective, has really... where there's been positive dialogue on this issue has been able to really propose alternatives and models. You don't need to lock up. There are different ways of doing it. And our research found the most successful of all the alternative to detention programs included government working with civil society. There was no question. It wasn't about how many restrictions you put on that person, how much they had to report to immigration or ankle braces. That wasn't the indicator of success. It was really... a couple of factors that people could survive in the community, that they weren't destitute, that they were able to be informed about what their options are, including legal advice, and also that civil society and government work together to make sure that a person is treated fairly. So a brief snapshot, if I can, on what we found. We found that alternatives to detention are far cheaper. They are about 80% cheaper, which is around $100 a day cheaper on average. So rather than putting someone in the community in a supported setting as opposed to in detention. And they work as well. I mean, it was interesting. We looked at, there were global statistics for about 20 programs that had very similar statistics, that where those elements that I mentioned were in place, there was 90%+ compliance, which meant people appeared, they didn't disappear. And when someone was asked to go home, it varied from 65 to 85%. And it was interesting arriving, I just arrived in the US and discovered that those statistics are very, that correlate to the situation here in the US, which is, I'm sure we'll hear about, but I think the learning is that governments often don't know the population as well as the community groups. So in a sense, there's a benefit for governments to work together with civil society on this issue. So,
thanks a lot, Grant. You were talking about the U.S. and what is going on in the U.S., and we're going to give an opportunity to Megan to give us a... an overview of what's at play. I know that LIRS released a report in 2011, which is titled Unlocking Liberty. And could you tell us more about what happened?
Sure. Can you hear me? Okay. I'll give you a quick rundown, just a brief history, because I know Mr. Lorenz and Mr.
Detail on this. But I also want to, oftentimes when we get together here in the U.S. and we talk about this in the adult context. So I want to give you a snapshot of three different systems, really, because here we have enforcement that works with unaccompanied minors. We also work with families as a unit, and also enforcement specific for the adult population. So I'll start out with the smallest of the systems, family detention in the United States. For the vast majority of families who are in the enforcement system, they are not detained as men. sadly, some of them who are caught up in custody are separated. But there is one family detention facility in the United States, up in Pennsylvania. It has fewer than 100 people for its capacity. And families are going through their the option length of stay is a couple months. This is a change because even just a few years ago, there were two facilities and more than double the families in custody. The facility out in Hutto, Texas was closed, gosh, 3 years ago now? It was about 3 years ago, and that facility actually was converted and houses women now. But there, so, you know, the question that we always have then, well, when families are up on an independent border as a unit, if they're not being detained, what's happening to them? And how is civil society partnering with the government to find options for them? I think that we have a really critical moment right now in the history of prioritizing family unification, that there are not a whole lot of options for families presenting themselves at the border. And the government is scrambling and making calls to NGOs and civil society primarily to find housing, because the family coming and they don't have someone to go to here in the United States, there are very few options. You're not going to want to send a family to a homeless shelter. So what do you do if you don't want to detain them? This is a real question for both civil society and the U.S. government right now, because the policies are, they're advocating to not keep the families in detention, and they're advocating to keep them unified. But the options really aren't there, the infrastructure. So with that said, we look at what are we doing with children. There has been a lot of reform, and my ears perked up because I agree. Reform here in the U.S. is often driven by the awareness of cost of current systems and litigation. And sadly, not always reform is driven, in the case of children, it is, driven by the harmful impact on a population. We don't always quantify that and mobilize around the harm the system causes to create reform, but in the case of children, all three issues really drove the reform. There was a huge legislative overhaul because of the awareness of the impact that detention has on children, and also because of the litigation around the conditions of detention, because children previously had been detained in the same facilities as adults, and our domestic child welfare standards were not applied, and egregiously not applied. They're now, part of the shift was that instead of Immigration Customs Enforcement maintaining custody of unaccompanied children, they are now held in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, ORR, which falls under Health and Human Services. So it has more of a service mission than an enforcement mission. But nonetheless, they have great responsibility for the increasing numbers of unaccompanied children in their care. I don't know if you've been following the news over the last 2 years, but there is a massive increase in the number of children arriving unaccompanied at our borders, coming into ORR custody. Now, they will be in shelter care, which is the pseudonym for detention. They will be held in detention, but child-specific immigration detention facilities for short periods while they do an assessment of the child's strength, needs, and possibilities for reunification with family member or family friends here in the United States. They try and keep that at a fairly short time because what they want to do is explore as many alternatives to detention as they can for these children. And by and large, only about 10% of the unaccompanied children that come into ORR custody are kept for the duration of their removal proceedings in detention. So the vast majority are placed either in the foster care system, and that could be ranged from small groups of homes to individual foster homes, or they could be reunified with a family member or other sponsor. I don't think that's just a bizarre category thing. And I have been told that the other sponsors are usually family friends. Forward. And one of the things that gives civil society a lot of anxiety with the process is that ORR in these woeful budgetary times is really feeling the need to expedite relief of these children because of the cost of detaining them and all the services that they provide while they're in custody of the federal government is quite expensive. And the population has, I think, tripled in the last year. It's quadrupled in the last year. So they have actually tried to expedite the release of these children. And in order to do so, they have stopped their staff from implementing some of the protective measures that ensure safe release. So, for example, if a sponsor comes forward, they no longer have to have a fingerprint and a background check because that process takes quite some time. They're being released now without a full vetting process. So, in the children's context, I think that it's always a tricky balance when we talk about alternatives to detention, because while we don't want the children to be in an institutional setting, we also understand that there are certain needs to make sure that they're released from custody in a safe manner that's not going to make them vulnerable here in our country for further exploitation, abuse, not treatment. Now, in the adult context, we have also had significant changes in the landscape of alternatives to detention over the last decade, well, really 15 years, because in the mid to late 90s, there was a lot of exciting activity going on with public-private partnerships. More informally, there were some communities particularly responding in areas like Maryland, Florida, responding to the Midwest, that were coming together and working with the local ICE field offices and saying, hey, you know what, we've been working with these communities for some time, and we want to receive them and provide support while they're going through removal proceedings. We know that they don't need to be detained, and we can offer the services to make sure that they can comply with all the conditions of release. They're appearing for their hearings, and if necessary, they're making the proper arrangements with our support for removal. So you saw our Catholic Charities, Lutheran Immigration Refugee Service, where I'm working. These are two good examples of NGOs that stepped up, and we're doing small local projects in partnership with ICE to support people coming out of detention while their removal proceedings were pending. Then you also had a very formalized study that covered about 500 people in the New York area over 3 years, run by the Vera Institute for Justice. It was a wild success. The individual outcomes, both tracking the outcomes for well-being and integration in addition to the governance outcomes of interest, compliance with appearing at their hearing, complying with final orders of removal. All of this was wildly successful, so successful that Congress was convinced that this is a good direction for appropriation, and they actually created money for ICE. Well, I guess beginning of my timeline, was it ICE then? It was INS initially then, during this period, because the data was really out in 2001. And you know, they said, go for it, please, and try this ATD. Well, there was some disappointment, I have to say, because the funds were then used for a civil detention facility, trying to shift away from the incarceration model facilities. In fact, I mean, if you have been working on immigration issues, I'm sure you know that there's about 250 facilities across the country that ICE holds immigrants in. Some of them are contract facilities at local jails, primarily county jails. And they were trying to shift away from this model, build designated facilities or retrofit facilities there was more freedom of movement. It was less jail-like. But this was not what civil society envisioned as an alternative detention. It's not what the Bureau Institute of Justice had piloted, because their pilot involved actual community-based living. It had intensive case management, and all the services were community-based. So there, right around this time, we had the backlash from 9/11, and because of the heightened security concerns, there was an assumption that detention was necessary for the security of our community. And the community-based models that we were so hopeful for coming out of the 1990s were really dashed. And it's only been in the last couple years that local organizations have been mobilizing again with new hope that they can reapproach the federal government and say, please partner with us for a true community-based alternative to detention. And I think a little bit later, maybe I can go into some more details now, whatever, about there are seven locations across the country now that are actually piloting a new model for community support as a form of alternative.
Thank you, Megan. We're most likely to come back to that. Anyways, let's give Andrew an opportunity to chip in as well. And Megan was talking about the community support network and the case management business, so on and so forth. And I know that ICE has been behind all this, working in concert with NGOs, and in particular LIRS. Could you tell us more about
it? I can, but I want to take it back a little bit to ground everyone in some more statistics, because it's interesting when you think about the scale, and Grant talks about the international scale. So let me give you a playing field of what it means to be an immigration detention and ATD in the United States. So at any given time, we have 34,000 people in immigration detention, okay? Largest system in the world, I think. Yeah. When we were up in Canada and Buffalo, we were talking, it was with my Canadian colleagues in Australia, and they were talking about the few hundred they had that year. And I said, I have a 34,000 that day, 400,000 throughout the course of a year. Now, that sounds like a lot, but let me give you the comparison of the release options. 34,000 in detention, but 1.7 million going through the system on the non-detained docket. So in comparison, quite low. 300 of those 1.7 million are active cases. Where we have release options, the traditional ATD program that Megan talked about, that Vera kind of started, it now became with one private contractor, and we can discuss that. That's with a behavioral institute. Now it's owned by GEO, which actually builds facilities. That's about 23,000 people today on traditional alternatives of detention, private contractor. Think of this as intense supervision. We call it electronic monitoring. You call it ankle bracelets. It's the same. It's about 23,000 people. Okay, and that's in the people outside of detention. On bond, and an immigration bond is different than a criminal bond, you got to pay the full amount. 20,000 people on bond. Thousands of others on orders of recognizance, that's a pre-order order, or orders of supervision, that's post-order of a judge. Also interesting facts about ATD, traditional with the private contract, and I'll get to the new community one we're doing now. About $100 less than detention per day. Detention costs on average $122 per day to maintain someone in detention. I agree it is cheaper when you compare it that way. Average length of stay in immigration detention is 26 days. 50% of the population is out within 8 days. When you're on the non-detained docket, which is not fast-tracked in the court system, you can have a longer aggregate cost on ATD. You will find that 97% of those released on the private contractor ATD have a successful appearance at their last hearing, which is great for our traditional ATD. 5% absconder data on that, and 82% of those who are ordered removed will actually be removed, which is something we're leaking ATD with completion to orders of removal, because in general, releases from detention have a higher removal than relief rate. Another interesting fact, while yes, we have 250 50 facilities, 80% of our population is in 46 facilities. So I think that's very interesting. Going to where we are thinking about ATD, and today is monumental for a couple reasons, because we actually signed this memorandum of understanding with the Lutherans that the government of the United States will do community-sponsored release formally starting June 1st. We have done it ad hoc, and we've done it. We have officers in San Antonio, all these pilot sites where we'll call and say, do you have bed space, and do you have medical care for these folks? Can you deal a lot with our vulnerable populations? I'll talk maybe a little later about our risk assessment tool. But we've now formalized that agreement, and it may not make a big difference to you all, but it is a big, big thing that we've actually entered this agreement, because for the first time, the government has said ATD can be community-sponsored release, and we're going to put our efforts towards it. Now, it's not going to be big initially. We're not going to talk thousands of people, but we think the compliance data can be good enough that we can look to actually seek to Congress and say, hey, let's go back to what we thought in the 90s. And I say, let's go back to what we did in 1890, because in 1890, it wasn't the government doing this. It was you all. It was the civil society. They came over on the ships. The ships had to do immigration control. They got off at the harbors, and Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society was there, the New York Jewish Foundation. All these groups were there, the Lutherans, the Catholics. That's what they did in the 1890s. We should do it in 2013. And so it's great that we're doing this for the first time. I'm very, very excited about it. It will pilot in San Antonio, which has, if you've read the accounts in the media, has the largest right now influx of people coming over the border. We call it the Rio Grande Valley. And we're seeing thousands upon thousands of adults and children. And so this will be very key in that jurisdiction. It will also be key in the New York, New Jersey area, which is our second pilot site. We're very, very excited about it. We already have other partners wanting to do the same, and we think if we get the data right and we show, and we can see this through international practices, we see it ad hoc, it's not been formalized yet, we think the Congress will take note, we think civil society will promote it, and DHS leadership is already behind it.
Thanks so much, Andrew. When Grant started, he seemed to suggest that he's talking about a shift. Somebody else would be talking about a transformation, big change, 2008-2009. What owes to that? He seemed to suggest President Obama. Is it the only factor?
Well, we always give credit to the president, right? But I have to tell you that, and I think, Bhuti, you called to attention to civil society. The fact that I just mentioned this MOU, that was civil society. The fact that I recognize half the room means that we have vested players here. That led to detention reform. The supporters of the administration and the president made sure that that was part of the agenda. The president put in leaders who were supportive of that. My director, John Morton, was very supportive of that. Secretary Napolitano, a border governor, was supportive of that. And it just made sense. And Director Morton and the secretary will tell you, as will many people in the audience, we have not come fast enough. One fact I have to tell you about this, when we say ATD, alternatives to detention, it's not mean the detention of 34,000 is going to decrease. Congress mandates a 34,000 bed day rate, meaning it's an alternative to detention for that person. We may save detention for Bob or Sally, but 34,000 people at any given day in this country will be maintained in U.S. detention for whatever reason the Congress has saw fit to put that in the law. So we're still driving the agenda. We're still trying to make reforms, but it has been a concerted effort. All these things have been done in tandem with civil society. We try to move at a fast pace, but it's us attending these international conferences. It's us working with our NGO partners, but I think that really drove it, and we're trying to make as much steps forward as we can at the pace we can, because as Megan mentioned, immigration in this country has been a reactive politics. We have had major events happen in this country, whether or not it's the World Trade Center bombing in 93 that led to controls in 96, or whether or not it's 2001 with 9/11 that led to new policies. And we forget sometimes the historical context, and I think civil society gives that to us and is there at the table to kind of maintain that, hey, we did it before, we can do it again, it's going to work, and it's doing all that great work. And I know that I've been privileged enough to work with all you folks doing that, and we've actually made some great strides forward because of that pressure, even though sometimes it's intense.
Thanks, Andrew. For those who understand the humility that drives UNHCR, you must have understood my question. I was, in fact, trying to push him to say that it's UNHCR and I was who is the guy.
The United Nations is right there with us.
Getting back to the project, Megan, you wanted to say something quite quickly on that?
Yeah, I was just going to give a
quick synopsis of it. And so I mentioned that it's in seven localities, and in two of them we're collaborating with ICE for a formalized process of referrals for the program. But just a quick summary that, you know, this is, it's built on a case management model for service delivery, so everyone is connected with someone who's going to help them navigate the community services that are available in order to improve the access to existing services. But the program is also doing an investment of private funding to expand the availability of services for case management, for legal, and for housing. And I think that's really the biggest challenge, because while, you know, I mean, I'm actually a lawyer, and I used to be working in the field representing these folks, and so usually I beat the drum about how woefully underserved everyone is with pro bono legal services, and I hope all of you, we're out of law school, my goodness, I hope all of you are going to be very near future for the rest of your careers logging a tremendous number of pro bono legal service hours. But housing is a serious crisis, because the people, most of the people that we're working with, they cannot get out of detention unless they have an address, a place to go to. And then it can't just be a perfunctory address that they put down there. It has to be a place that's going to provide stability for a period of their lives where they're probably not going to have employment. Because even if they come out with employment authorization, which is certainly not very easy, they have so many other things going on to divert their focus. The job market, everyone's at risk of long-term unemployment. But these folks usually don't have any income coming in. So they need someone who's going to provide housing for, Andrew mentioned how long the job is, for a couple of years without necessarily the legal protection or the employment that they need. And it is the biggest barrier to moving the community-based support forward. It's the lack of housing. And our partners across the country have been doing some creative things to try and fill that need. Some of them are using community engagement to open up private homes for people coming out of detention. Some folks have been mobilizing the community to rehab old houses and opening up centers of hospitality. Some people, in fact, who are doing those centers of hospitality are really investing wholeheartedly as a community initiative, and community members are living there intentionally as a sign of support for these folks, that they're accompanying them through the entire process. I stumbled across that because there are so many stories that I could tell you right now about the bonds that have been created through this. And I think one of the things that drives us moving forward on long hours of we're living is that because these folks are being received into the community, they're building bonds that are helping them to get straight. They're not going through this alone. And I can say that truly. It's not just the service providers, it's certainly not just the attorneys that are accompanying them through this time, but they're building connection with their neighbors, with the local residents. And
rates, which I hope you're really happy to see. So the network is really trying to meet not just the basic needs, but then create a family, a community for these folks, so that they can come and ask for the support that they may have been ashamed to ask for because it was disempowering, or that they may have lost all hope and stopped asking for before they entered this program. So the network approach is important for us, but I think that one of the things that's a critical marker of this is that there's over 20 local agencies that are sharing the decisions, the planning, and the budgeting for this movement. And I don't use the word movement lightly, but you know, we have some folks who've been around the table sitting up there in the back, and they're mobilizing at the local level and at the national level. Every little detail of this is a consensus reaching process, and I think that that's really important because there's not enough services out there to meet the need, and unless we're leveraging one another's strengths as a civil society, we're not going to be able to fill this gap. And so that's my plea as well. I always have to do this when I come and talk to students, that there are a lot of opportunities to volunteer, and especially as you go into summer internships, I would love for you to come talk to us afterwards.
I just want to say one fact that we have to give praise to the Lutherans, because I mentioned that it's about $20 a day on ATD, and millions of dollars by the Congress has been appropriated, but none of it is going to the Lutherans, and they're doing it pro bono at a stretched network. And I will be on the record and say that ICE wants more people to go into the sponsorship, but because of the lack of housing and services, and I've actually gone to the sites myself and talked to the providers, and I've seen it. You know, people, when you're going to do court appearances right on the non-detained docket, and you're at the Casa Marinella in San Antonio, and you get a court date of 14 months from now, and you've got to care for that person, right? Or you have these issues. And so it's a community thing. So while I want to partner with the community, we need more community partners, because the Lutherans need to be successful in their model, and the only way to do that is with everyone joining in.
I can almost feel your eagerness to ask a question, and I'm going to give you the opportunity to do so. Any questions for the amazing panel? Please.
I have a question for Mr. Lorenzen Strait and Grant and Megan, certainly if you have a response as well. But you mentioned sort of this hope about congressional action and seeing sort of the success of these.
Right.
But what do you think is going to be the influence of these private, you know, companies like GEO and CCA who lobby pretty hard in the millions of dollars to their representatives and senators? How do you think that's going to influence this conversation?
Well, there's two ways you look at the private industry working with ICE. One is the detention setting, and the other is the alternative detention setting. Well, with the detention settings, it's probably a separate discussion. I don't find sometimes their interaction with the private corporations to be a bad thing. Actually, we've built most of our civil detention centers with private industry. We actually can move at a faster pace with private industry on that. When it comes to the ATD, I think we're all concerned, because what happened when we went to the VERA model, right, is it went out for proposal, and who got the bid was private industry, because you got to go through this government procurement process. And so what I think you have to do is you got to show that there's, when you do the bids and you do the thing, that there's going to be success rates. And that's why we're doing this. We're smart about this. I think all of us have learned the lessons over the past 15 years, and with UNHCR and with the Lutherans and with our international colleagues, to know, hey, how are we going to plot this? And we have made sure that the reporting and how we're going to do our pilot for the year has triggers that we think Congress will like. And also make it easier for us to, when we want to get this to be funded, needed to be successful, because we don't want to go through that again. We don't want to repeat the history. And we do want to get to a place, because we've seen it with our international colleagues, with Australia, with Canada, and other places. You can work with civil society. This can happen, and it doesn't have to be a for-profit model, per se.
I think it's interesting, Australia, as Andrew said, Australia and the US has been in very similar situation. If we were sitting in Europe right now, if we were in Germany, Sweden, there are government-funded housing reception centres, for example, for asylum seekers. My country, Australia, the US, we don't have that. So the housing crisis that you're facing was faced in Australia for years and years and years. And what was interesting was a recent decision by the government over the last couple of years is to finally divert some of its detention funds into effective community programs, investing in the community as opposed to just the prison system. So my last job was running at the Red Cross. I ran Australia's biggest alternative to detention program, which now, as of, I said, it's doubled. It's one quarter of the total detention budget, which is $1 billion in Australia. $250 million goes to the Red Cross to work with NGOs all across Australia because of this crisis that we had. Obviously, the US is a different situation, but I think it's interesting the Australian government saw the benefit of investing in infrastructure locally, building up that capacity, and working with civil society. So I would hope that that's a possibility.
Thank you. I think I saw a hand.
From Mr. Lawrence and Street, do you have a sense if Congress is sort of tuning into the ATD program and sort of the growth, and with, I think, the recent announcement that there might be a potential bill coming out recently, do you have a sense of ATD as a bigger component of that?
Well, I think there's more pulse of the room on CIR and that, and other people in the room than me. I've been in the weeds with the executive branch, but I do sense that. I do think that a lot of the folks in civil society have pushed that, and I think they've pushed it in a way that they want to correct the wrongs as they've seen it, to make sure that we look at it this way, because I do think while the current ATD model is basically it's intense supervision with case managers, and it's also electronic monitoring, it's not what we're proposing. It's not embedding someone in a house in a residential setting, working with them comprehensively on their life skills, employment. You know, when you think about the arc of where we want people to be, gaining relief or adjusting to status, this model that we're proposing and we're signing is what we really want versus just the technical requirements of getting to the appointment, right? Showing up when you need to show up. I think the data will prove successful because it'll show a longer integration arc and ability to be more successful in that realm. But I do think, I've heard the buzz that I think the people are pushing this type of alternatives to detention and really exploring in general just the framework of immigration detention and enforcement in the country, as we are hopeful that people on the Hill do the right thing.
Well, yes, please.
I guess a two-part question, or maybe two separate questions I'm trying to cram into one.
That's compound objection.
Yeah. I guess the first is for you, Andrew, and it references what Grant just spoke about. Have there been conversations about routing some of this funding for the 34,000 beds towards the community-based model? And then the other question is, Megan, you mentioned that that housing is one of the biggest barriers with the community-based model, and I was just curious what some of the other ones are aside from just buy-in.
Well, I love your first question. That shows you're new to this area. There have been many efforts, and in fact, if you paid attention in the last several months, you've seen some efforts of ICE releasing some folks and being called to the Hill and slapped on the wrist for doing that. The Congress has been very clear. Most people really didn't understand why that is. There's an appropriations mandate, and a lot of people have asked. The president's budget, looked at a different number, right? But it is something I think that is in the conversation that needs to be looked at. ICE, we are part of the enforcer of the law. We carry out the law. For our perspective, say that that's the mandate, that's the mandate. And now it's about not if we're going to do that, but who is going to be in those 34,000 beds, right? It's the alternative detention for that individual, not necessarily alternative detention for someone who may be in detention, which is kind of an interesting concept because you're thinking, well, he doesn't have to go to detention, but you know, there's going to be 34,000 people in there. And so I'll leave Megan for the other topic.
Well, we think of the need for an effective effective system run across BORDEC. So we need to make sure that all the services that that people need are going to be accessible, that they're going to be available, that they're acceptable to the consumers of the service, and also that their quality according to the best practice standards of whatever discipline. So legal, housing, mental health, and medical services. It has to be up to so, in this, the biggest barriers to achieving that really is availability of services. I think that in this model, we're working with community-based organizations that already are very culturally competent, have extensive professional training of how to work with people who are coming from different cultures, different generations, you know, with particular vulnerabilities and sort of the language that we use that's kind of drives me nuts, but the special populations. And they've been doing this for decades, so that's sort of a no-brainer. Are they quality? I mean, we're absolutely looking for partners that have a long-standing reputation of success in their community. So that stuff's easy. Accessibility, if you have a case manager who's empowering the client based on their strengths, they're going to be able to give the information, the resources, and the referrals to make the services accessible. It's just availability. And it's a big problem because we're talking about non-citizens, many of whom have squishy in-between status because their cases are pending and service providers generally don't know what to do with that. And so it's kind of complicated to figure out, do they have access to certain public benefits? Even when their cases are completed, it's a challenge, as you've been watching the healthcare debate, what non-citizens can access healthcare, which ones cannot. And most of the people that we're working with are not going to have access. And, you know, so that's asking nonprofit organizations to raise the funding to provide specific to this population. And, you know, so it sort of is a vicious cycle that then bumps up again to the political barriers. I think that there's still, even in the philanthropic community, there's not a prioritization of investing in this population as part of our community. And we firmly believe that our communities are only going to be strong if there is successful integration for the newcomers. And people then shoot back to that and say, well, not all of them are going to stay. So why should we invest in people whose cases are still to be determined? And, you know, that's where, from a faith-based organization, you know, we say that we have a moral obligation to accompany them while they're here in our community. And by and large, a lot of them are going to stay. So if you don't invest in each one of them from day one, you're shooting our communities in the foot for those who are going to stay, because now they're behind the law and they're not going to integrate successfully because you didn't want, you put into or you didn't want to disable us. And so that lack of civil society commitment to invest is what makes it so difficult to build available.
Thank you, Megan. I am conscious of time. We're running over.
You can go over for a little bit.
Okay. Professor Sina says, if I go over 6 o'clock, I'll get fired, isn't it?
Okay. Can't fire you.
5 more minutes. Okay, thank you. Mike?
Yeah, I just had a quick question for Andrew. When you look at bids from companies like Geo and the different the private contractors, do you look at cost? I mean, presumably that's the biggest thing, but what are some of the other things that you look at? Do you ever look at soft things like?
Well, not going too much into the procurement process, but you know, there's requests for proposals, there's requests for information. We lay out with our statement of objectives on what we are seeing, we want to see in the bids. We don't hide the ball of what we want to have happen. In fact, most of our detention principles are kind of most enumerated in our statement of objective documents when we built new facilities, right? Freedom of movement, access to recreation, etc. What it comes down to, I think, why sometimes the community groups have been unable to kind of mount this. It's like there's an industry that they know how to do the right things, say the right words. They have the abilities with the funds, etc. So I'm hoping, though, with there are some good organizations that can do this. You know, LIRS and the Catholics kind of put a network together, but there's like Heartland Alliance in the Midwest. There are some good groups that I think if we scope the document, if we, you know, end up going to look to do this for funds, would be competitive in their bid process. Because we've laid it out exactly what we need. We need to have housing that looks like this, right, in communities. We need to have people who are social or case manager-like persons. And that would be more in line with the model we're going to pilot.
I have a two-part question. The first part is there's been a lot of discussion lately about how electronic monitoring, supervision orders are very restrictive and very invasive and are not necessarily what people envision when they think of as alternatives to detention. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to the difference between alternative forms of detention from alternatives to detention and what the mental impacts are on people. Is it still is alternative form of detention, because they're out of detention, which is preferable, I would assume, does it still have the benefits that we would see in alternatives to detention? And then my next question, which I think should probably be the closing question, would be, can you guys talk about if this is the way forward? Is this where we should be moving?
Well, let me give you the government's case, and I know that my NGO partner might say it's a little different about alternative detention, right? We think they're not detention. We say that ATD is not a form of detention, electronic monitoring. We've also, this is your plug, Booty, with UNHCR, especially with stateless individuals, where you have maybe rigid reporting requirements. We did a new policy memo in collaboration with UNHCR, where that reporting requirements are much more laxed and are given at the discretion and can be as much as just one time a year. And so we have looked at that and made sure that it's not too onerous and it's based upon individuals' case circumstances. And that was a great day that we did that policy shift. But, you know, we've heard that before, but we do believe strongly that this isn't what detention is. It is not a pretrial, not a civil-like detention facility, that it is an alternative to that. It's a release continuum based upon your flight risk, public safety issues, and it may be intensive supervision. It may be an order of supervision. It may be a bond, but it's some mechanism by which we believe you're going to appear at your court hearing, appear at your final removal if that's guaranteed, and produce yourself and be effective in the immigration process.
I mean, just to, from our perspective and looking at this internationally, we differ slightly in the fact that we do make a very clear distinction of what constitutes a deprivation of liberty equaling detention. So where someone's freedom of movement is affected or restrictions are overly onerous. So, you know, you've seen everything from the way curfews are used. You know, there's some freedom of movement, but there's ultimately restrictions on freedom of movement. But I think going back to what I said before, what's been really important to us is that it's actually the success of these programs is less what restrictions you put on people, but more how you empower people. And I think what is exciting, I mean, this is an exciting day for me. I've been here every year since the reform was announced in 2009. So to actually
have this conversation to actually see that this community models are being piloted and explored together with ICE is pretty exciting. And I think the reason for it is that it encapsulates what we found of what works. The two things that we found internationally was very innovative ways governments are making informed decisions of whether they need to detain or not, which is what ICE is now starting to do through its risk assessment tool, which wasn't there a few years ago. A lot of other countries are looking at that model. And secondly, how rather than locking someone up to try to make, you know, to try to force a return, how you can manage that process in the community, which is part of what this new model is. I think the challenge and the way forward, and I think this is, to answer your question, from my opinion, it is a discussion on the way forward. I think it's how to turn these innovative pilots, and I think pilots are a great way to explore something, international programs that are sustainable. And I think that's going to be, and I think the ongoing continued international discussions and what how other pilots have successfully transitioned will be important. So.
That you know, I mean, if you're looking at the spectrum of restrictions, you know, detention being the most restrictive, I mean, there are lots of forms of custody that fall short of detention, in our opinion. And it would be wonderful to have some breathing room with the mandatory custody provision for migrants in this country by using an alternative detention to still meet that mandate. But I think to the question of, you know, is this the way forward? I think that I'm optimistic that Congress is going to take out the mandate for a certain level of beds to be filled or to at least be maintained. I'm very hopeful there. But I think that without congressional action, I'm skeptical about our ability to move forward as a country with alternatives to detention that are community-based and a real partnership between civil society and the federal government. Because time and time again, we sit down and we do come to a meeting of the minds between civil society and government, the barrier for our collaboration to move forward is some of the congressional mandate. So I'm hopeful that CIR will have a positive impact, not so much that it's going to tweak our system so much, but it's going to create a new climate in Congress where they feel empowered for immigration reform, that they can then move on to some of these aspects without feeling that they're going to be voted out of office. So let's see in 2 years how this goes.
Let's say just a word on
just the way. Oh, I mean, yeah. I mean, I think we have to. We can't exist in this world, whether it's on my side of the with the government or with the NGO community or with UNHCR or international colleagues, unless we were optimistic. Because if we weren't optimistic, I don't know how we get up every day. Because it's so clear to us what needs to happen. And sometimes, I think someone mentioned the secretary said the word arbitrary today, and I won't tell you the context, but sometimes it feels like that. And us who are doing it day in and day out want to see this be successful. And I can tell you, we had to meander a lot of gauntlets and hurdles just to get to sign this MOU today. And so today I'm on an optimistic note, and I agree with her that I think we're going to get there. I think we've seen for far too long the lack of inertia what we're doing, and that won't prevail. And I think it will be successful. The model will show results, and I look to a day where I'm handing over the check instead of just the pen to sign the MOU. So yes.
Thank you very much. I think that they deserve a and I would like to thank you as well for having come and all share and your expertise as it exudes from the mouths of the amazing challenges that we have had. And thank you very much, Professor Sina.
Thank you. I wanted to thank UNHCR for co-hosting this panel and putting in a wonderful discussion together. I wanted to thank the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law here at WCL, and of course, last but not least, the WCL Student-Led Immigrant Rights Coalition. So on behalf of those three conveners, I'd like to invite you guys for some food and drinks in room 600. If the panelists can stay, that would be great. I promise on your behalf not to accost them, right? Let them enjoy. So yes, see you in